We now hear that Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak will be speaking around 3 o'clock Eastern Time this afternoon. Egyptian state television is reporting that he's meeting with his recently appointed Vice President Omar Suleiman. Mr. Suleiman has been deeply enmeshed in the current regime and many of its controversial policies. In his previous job as head of Egypt's FIR General Intelligence Service, he had a long history of assisting the United States with its rendition program. His work and his involvement in alleged torture has been so extensive that Mr. Suleiman has been described in many quarters as the CIA's man in Cairo. Joining us now is Lisa Hajar, Associate Professor at the University of California at Santa Barbara, and I'm very pleased to welcome her to our show for today's first Backstory segment. Hello.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
What Mr. Mubarak is going to say remains unknown, and who succeeds him if he does leave is also unknown, but we know from a number of WikiLeaks diplomatic cables that U.S. officials have assumed for years that Mr. Suleiman will be a major figure in any scenario involving a transition from power from President Mubarak. Has he been the favorite choice of policymakers in Washington?
Well, certainly if the two choices were between Suleiman, who WikiLeaks documents had referred to as Mubarak's consigliere, or Gamal Mubarak, who was deeply loathed within Egypt and not seen as a particularly good successor to his father. I think that certainly Suleiman would have been, in Washington, the preferred choice.
Well, recently,
and he remains in some ways preferred now by Washington, by Israel, and by the European Union, in the sense that they perceive him as someone who may be able to sort of put Egypt back on the road to stability. But quite frankly, that's not at all what the pro-democracy protesters are seeking. They're seeking an end to the entire regime.
So how is he regarded? Are people aware of his checkered past?
Well, in fact, Suleiman was not the institution that he headed was, one might say, equivalent to the CIA, except it was part of the military itself. So much of his work and his mandate had to do with international issues. In particular, as you mentioned, you know, he was deeply involved from the beginning with the United States rendition program, which actually began under Clinton and then became extraordinary rendition under President Bush. And he held the Israel dossier for the foreign ministry since during this last decade. But many Egyptians, because of the fact that what his work was involved in was mainly international terrorism and security issues, he wasn't widely known. In fact, I think he was really thrust into the Egyptian domestic limelight when he was anointed as vice president several weeks ago. But one could say that the more they know him, the less they like him. I mean, he's been doing a number of things just in the last few weeks to make him appear completely uncredible, even as a transitional figure.
Was he appointed because he was our man? Because his public relationship with the Obama White House has been kind of strained lately, hasn't it?
I think what happened was, you know, in the context of these mass demonstrations that began on January 25th, Hosni Mubarak was trying to figure out, you know, how to get the people out of the streets, hang on to power, and, you know, do something. So clearly, the grooming of his son had been one of many aspects about Mubarak's own legacy, not to mention his authoritarianism, his, you know, record of torture, repression, and so on. But his son was considered part of the problem. So Hosni Mubarak made a very shrewd move by essentially sidelining and ultimately, you know, tossing his son under the bus and bringing in Suleiman as vice president because he realized that Suleiman is a known entity in Washington. And at that time, there was a lot of, you know, U.S. media attention was devoted to the question of whether or not, a change of regime or democracy in Egypt would be dangerous for Israel. So he was also extraordinarily well-liked in Israel because of his deep anti-Islamism and his willingness to, you know, on the Egyptian end of things, to help maintain the crushing blockade of Gaza. So I think Mubarak saw him as someone who would be palatable. But, you know, as things have progressed over the last few weeks, it's clearly that, you know, the demonstrators will stop at nothing until Mubarak is out. And today, people chanting in the regime that they want the whole regime down. So Suleiman is going to be in an equally tenuous position in the coming days if Mubarak does hand power over to him.
There's also strong anti-Israeli sentiment among some of the protesters. I've seen some carrying pictures of Mubarak with a Star of David over his face. Protester told a reporter, how do we have to tell Mubarak we want him to leave? Should we speak to him in Hebrew? So is that also an issue? Are people aware of Suleiman's relationship with Israel?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, that is something that I believe has been relatively covered, and particularly, as I said, you know, the sentiment in Egypt and much of the Arab world is very sort of empathetic to the plight of Palestinians living under protracted occupation. And so and there was a great deal of sympathy and for Palestinians in Gaza, you know, during the period of Operation Cast-Lead and in the end of 2008, 2009, December, January. And Suleiman, you know, as Egyptians would know, was committed in alliance with Israel to blocking, you know, the movement of food and supplies into Gaza, sort of helping to maintain the blockade. Suleiman himself had said that, he was quite willing to let Gazans, you know, live on the, you know, barest bones just to keep them alive in terms of food stuff.
He's anti-Hamas?
Oh, he's deeply anti-Hamas. I mean, Suleiman is intensely anti-Islamist because, of course, Egypt has a long history of Islamist violence, although the Muslim Brothers in Egypt have really over decades, you know, renounced the use of violence and become essentially, you know, sort of a socially conservative political party. But Suleiman, in his role as the head of the Egyptian General Intelligence Service, was really very much dealing with transnational Islamist terror organizations, and he's been a big saber rattler about, you know, for, you know, the Iranian regime, which of course endears him to neoconservatives in the United States. So Suleiman is an intensely anti-Islamist figure, which is why he was very much beloved by the Bush administration and the CIA in particular, and certainly by neoconservatives in the U.S.
I'm talking with Lisa Hajar, Associate Professor at the University of California at Santa Barbara. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. In your assessment, how different are the political philosophies of Mr. Suleiman and Mr. Mubarak?
I don't think there's much difference whatsoever. I mean, Suleiman has been nicknamed Mubarak's Mubarak. Mubarak himself, the one distinct difference, I think, is that Mubarak has used his repressive power, and particularly the neoliberal opening of Egypt over the last few decades, to enrich himself and his family massively. Speculations about Mubarak's fortune, or, you know, what we've heard is between 40 and 70 billion, which, if true, would make him one of the richest people in the world. Suleiman has not been involved in that kind of corporate, kleptocracy, which Gamal, the son, very much was. And that was one factor in Suleiman's resentment of Gamal Mubarak. So Suleiman doesn't have that particular aspect, but certainly he exhibits all of the traits that characterize the Egyptian regime, which is ruling through fear, disregard for, you know, democratic aspirations, hostile to the rule of law, probably would be comfortable to maintain, you know, the emergency laws which have been in place since, for 30 years.
A 2006 U.S. State Department memo says, quote, "Our intelligence collaboration with Omar Suleiman is now probably the most successful element of the U.S.-Egypt relationship." How far back does Mr. Suleiman's relationship with the U.S. government go? Is it just from when he became Egypt's top spy?
Well, he had trained in the 1980s at Fort Bragg. You know, I mean, the United States brings military officers from many, you know, allied countries for training in military and intelligence work. Then he became the head of the top spy of his country in 1993, and obviously then began an immediate and sustained relationship with the CIA in particular. In the mid-1990s, with the rise of al-Qaeda and the beginning of the kinds of attacks that al-Qaeda was claiming, both in Egypt, in Africa, and elsewhere, that was when President Bill Clinton devised the rendition program and did so very much in alliance with Egypt. So Soleimani was there, in a sense, from the beginning. In the 1990s, under Bill Clinton, there were a number of people who were picked up, kidnapped by the CIA, and transferred to various countries, notably Egypt, to stand trial. So it was the trial aspect that distinguished the rendition program from extraordinary rendition, which was instituted under President Bush, in which the CIA would kidnap suspects from anywhere in the world and then either disappear them into CIA black sites or send them to third countries for torture by proxy. And oftentimes people would move back and forth between black sites and these other countries. And Egypt was the top torture destination for the extraordinary rendition program. And Soleimani was directly involved in that, including cases in which he was personally involved in torturing some people at the behest of the United States government.
Don't many of the al-Qaeda higher-ups come from Egypt? Is that a reason that Egypt was so willing to engage in this?
Well, the Osama bin Laden's lieutenant, Ayman al-Zawahiri, is Egyptian. I think that al-Qaeda tracks people from various countries, and I mean, in fact, we don't really know much about who's in al-Qaeda now, but I think that it's certainly Zawahiri as the number two person being Egyptian is significant, and Zawahiri had been, tortured in Egyptian prisons, which in some ways contributed to his radicalization before he left to join Osama bin Laden in Afghanistan in the 1990s.
Well, Ron Susskind, the author of the book, The 1% Doctrine, told ABC News that when the CIA asked Soleimani for a DNA sample from a relative of Ayman al-Zawahiri, Soleimani offered the man's whole arm instead.
Right. And in fact, the story is even a little more fascinating. I saw Ron Susskind talking about it yesterday. A Afghani tribal warlord had captured somebody, decapitated him, claimed that the person he had captured was Zawahiri, and wanted his $25 million bounty, and so turned the head over to the United States. They extracted DNA from the molar of the head, and that's why they were requesting the DNA of Zawahiri's brother, who was in Egyptian prison.
Do we have a rough account as to how many terror suspects have been renditioned to Egypt at the request of the U.S. government?
Probably dozens. I mean, because of the fact that, you know, the rendition program and much of our torture policy remains unknown because we've never had a truth commission or expansion. What we do know is through the, you know, ACLU's efforts with FOIA and with other FOIA litigation. The estimation of there's been an estimated, 100 people who had been extraordinarily renditioned to various places. We know of probably at least a dozen ending up in Egypt. And some people sort of transited from black sites to perhaps Jordan, Egypt, back to Bagram, Guantanamo. So there was a lot of movement. When in the WikiLeaks document you'd cited from 2006, one of the reasons why Egypt becomes even more important around 2006 was because at the end of 2005, the Washington Post exposed the fact that the CIA had been operating black sites on the European continent, known later to be Poland, Romania, and Lithuania. And as soon as that story broke, the CIA had to get its prisoners off the continent because of the, you know, strong international law enforcement mechanisms there. And many of them were sort of transferred across the Mediterranean to either Morocco or Egypt or elsewhere.
There are two high-profile rendition cases in which Mr. Soleimani has been connected, the Egyptian-born Australian citizen Mamdouh Habib, who was captured in Pakistan in 2001, And it's never been proven that he even was connected to Islamic militants or al-Qaeda. And the other one, Ibn al-Sheikh al-Libi, who is renditioned by the U.S. to Egypt. What do we know about what happened to them and why Mr. Soleimani has been connected with their cases?
Well, I mean, he's been connected with every case of people who've been rendered into Egypt, but those two are, significant. We can talk first about the Habib case. Habib, in some ways, is representative of what was happening at that time in the late 2001, 2002, as the war on terror, in Afghanistan, Pakistan was just starting. The United States, and, as Ron Siskind's aptly titled book, The 1% Doctrine, the policy was being directed by Dick Cheney, and the perception guiding the U.S. because of its lack of intelligence about al-Qaeda was anybody who was in Pakistan or Afghanistan who was not Pakistani or Afghani should be assumed to be a terrorist. And so Habib was one of the, multitude of people who was picked up for not being, in the country of his choice. So he was arrested and tortured by the Pakistanis with CIA collusion. And then, because he is Egyptian-born, was, extraordinarily rendered to Egypt, where the brutal torture continued, electrocution, suspension by the wrists, and so on. And in his own book, My Story, he recounts the period where he was being tortured and he was slapped so hard on the face that his blindfold dislodged and he was able to see who it was that was torturing him. And it was Soleiman himself who was torturing Habib. Now, again, the way in which the torture program worked was this presumption that everyone who was being tortured was a terrorist and it was just a matter of breaking them to release this trove of actionable intelligence or confessions, and Habib was completely innocent, had nothing to say. So Soleiman later ordered, in order to sort of break Habib, ordered a guard to kill a Turkestani prisoner who was there in the same interrogation chamber, which the guard did with a vicious karate kick just to scare Habib.
So this is the next leader of Egypt?
Yes. Well, I mean, yes, indeed. But I think that the Ibn al-Libi story is even more significant globally. Ibn Sheikh al-Libi was, picked up in 2001 in Afghanistan, rendered ultimately to Egypt for torture, was considered to be, someone who would have intelligence. In the bill that, the United States under the Bush administration had wanted to go to war with Iraq and, in some ways had actually wished that they could have gone to war against Iraq instead of Afghanistan in 2001. But as the desires for a war with Iraq were building in 2002, in order to persuade the U.S. public and allies that there was a justification for extending the war on terror into Iraq, both CIA and military interrogators were under intense pressure to try and elicit actionable intelligence that there was some kind of an al-Qaeda Saddam Hussein connection. And it was in this context that al-Libi, many people were being, that was the spike in torture at that time, and al-Libi was one of those people, Soleiman directly seeking to, provide the information the ally United States was looking for. Al-Libi, brutally tortured, quote, confesses that in fact two al-Qaeda operatives had gone to Iraq to train in chemical and biological weapons. And that was one of two pieces of evidence that Colin Powell presented to the United Nations to make the case for war. The other one was the idea that Iraq was seeking to import yellowcake uranium for its active weapons program. The war begins, and we then subsequently learned that, of course, both the yellowcake story was a complete fabrication, as was the allegation that there was an al-Qaeda Saddam connection. It had been based on a tortured lie.
And al-Libi died in Libya.
Well, this becomes then the most nefarious part of this story, other than the fact that Libby's false confession led to the Iraq War and the hundreds of thousands of deaths and trillions of dollars. When it became clear that Libby, the war's on, and Libby recants his confession and said that, in fact, he'd said whatever his torturers wanted him to say, that became an embarrassing fact for both the United States and for Egypt. Libby disappeared. I mean, nobody knew where Libby was. People wanted to, you know, find him. And then in April 2009, Human Rights Watch investigators were in Libya doing reporting on prison conditions, and there they discovered Libby in a Libyan prison, talked to him and said he looked basically fine. But once it was revealed that Libby was alive and where he was, you know, the desire, the pressure to be able for people to talk to Libby about this false confession that had contributed to the start of the Iraq War was deeply humiliating to Suleiman, because Libby's false confession had come from Egypt. So Suleiman flies to Libya to meet with his counterpart, an intelligence leader who was Muammar Gaddafi's son. And by the time he departs, by the time his plane departs to go back to Egypt, Libby had committed, quote, suicide in his cell. And so that was one way to get rid of the embarrassing evidence.
Well, it really makes me feel good about the possibility that Omar Suleiman may be the next leader of Egypt. My great thanks to you, Lisa Hajar, Associate Professor at the University of California at Santa Barbara, for talking about him with us.
Thank you very much.